Let's go on a little longer. They went on. It was 2 hours, 2 hours of crowds and street battles and stray sniper fire before at last they could turn north. Then the scene changed. The gunfire receded, and they found themselves in a relatively affluent area of pleasant villas. They saw a child on a bicycle, wearing a t-shirt that said something about Southern California. Paul was tired. He had been in jail for 45 days, and during most of that time he'd been sick. He was no longer strong enough to walk for hours. "What do you say we hitchhike?" he asked Bill. "Let's give it a try." Paul stood at the roadside and waved at the next car that came along. He remembered not to stick out his thumb the American way. This was an obscene gesture in Iran. The car stopped. There were two Iranian men in it. Paul and Bill got in the back. Paul decided not to mention the name of the hotel. "We're going to Tajarish," he said. That was a bizarre area to the north of the city. "We can take you part of the way," said the driver. "Thanks." Paul offered them cigarettes, then sat back gratefully and lit one for himself. The Iranians dropped them off at Karush Kabir, several miles south of Tajarish, not far from where Paul had lived. They were in a main street with plenty of traffic and a lot more people around. Paul decided not to make himself conspicuous by hitchhiking here. "We could take refuge in the Catholic mission," Bill suggested. Paul considered. The authorities presumably knew that Father Williams had visited them in Gasser Prison just 2 days ago. "The mission might be the first place that God looks for us." "Maybe. We should go to the Hyatt." "The guys may not be there any longer." "But there'll be phones, some way to get plane tickets." "And hot showers." "Right." They walked on. Suddenly a voice called, "Mr. Paul, Mr. Bill." Paul's heart stopped. He looked around. He saw a car full of people moving slowly along the road beside him. He recognized one of the passengers. It was a guard from the Gasser prison. The guard had changed into civilian clothes and looked as if he had joined the revolution. His big smile seemed to say, "Don't tell who I am, and I won't tell who you are." He waved, then the car gathered speed and passed on. Paul and Bill laughed with a mixture of amusement and relief. They turned into a quiet street, and Paul started to hitchhike again. He stood in the road waving while Bill stayed on the sidewalk so that motorists might think there was only one man, an Iranian. A young couple stopped. Paul got into the car, and Bill jumped in after him. "We're headed north," Paul said. The woman looked at her man. The man said, "We could take you to Niavron Palace." "Thank you." The car pulled away. The scene in the streets changed again. They could hear much more gunfire, and the traffic became heavier and more frantic, with all the cars honking continually. They saw press cameramen and television crews standing on car roofs taking pictures. The mob was burning the police stations near where Bill had lived. The Iranian couple looked nervous as the car inched through the crowd. Having two Americans in their car could get them into trouble in this atmosphere. It began to get dark. Bill leaned forward. "Boy, it's getting a bit late," he said. "It sure would be nice if you all could take us to the Hyatt Hotel. We'd be happy to, you know, thank you and give you something for taking us there." "Okay," said the driver. He did not ask how much. They passed the Niavron Palace, the Shah's winter residence. There were tanks outside, as always, but now they had white flags attached to their antennae. They had surrendered to the revolution. The car went on, past wrecked and burning buildings, turned back every now and again by street barricades. At last they saw the Hyatt. "Oh boy," Paul said feelingly, "an American hotel." They drove into the forecourt. Paul was so grateful that he gave the Iranian couple $200. The car drove off. Paul and Bill waved, then walked into the hotel. Suddenly, Paul wished he were wearing his EDS uniform of business suit and white shirt instead of prison dungarees and a dirty raincoat. The magnificent lobby was deserted. They walked to the reception desk. After a moment, someone came out from an office. Paul asked for Bill Gayden's room number. The clerk checked and told him there was no one of that name registered. "How about Bob Young?" "No." "Rich Gallagher?" "No." "Jay Coburn?" "No." "I've got the wrong hotel," Paul thought. "How could I have made a mistake like that?" "What about John Howell?" he said, remembering the lawyer. "Yes," the clerk said at last, and he gave them a room number on the 11th floor. They went up in the elevator. They found Howell's room and knocked. There was no answer. "What do you think we ought to do?" Bill said. "I'm going to check in," said Paul. "I'm tired." "Why don't we check in? Have a meal. We'll call the States, tell them we're out of jail. Everything will be fine." "Okay." They walked back to the elevator.
Bit by bit, Keene Taylor got the story out of Rashid. He had stood just inside the prison gates for about an hour. The scene was a shambles. 11,000 people were trying to get out through a small doorway, and in the panic, women and old men were getting trampled. Rashid had waited, thinking of what he would say to Paul and Bill when he saw them. After an hour, the flood of people slowed to a trickle, and he concluded that most people were out. He started asking, "Have you seen any Americans?" Someone told him that all the foreigners had been kept in building number 8. He went there and found it empty. He searched every building in the compound. He then returned to the Hyatt by the route Paul and Bill were most likely to take. Walking and hitching rides, he had looked for them all the way. At the Hyatt, he had been refused admission because he was still carrying his rifle. He gave the gun away to the nearest youngster and came in. While he was telling his story, Coburn arrived, all set to go looking for Paul and Bill on Majid's motorcycle. He had a crash helmet with a visor that would hide his white face. Rashid offered to take an EDS car and drive the route between the hotel and the prison, making one more sweep there and back before Coburn risked his neck and the mobs. Taylor gave him the keys to a car. Gayden got on the phone to tell Dallas the latest news. Rashid and Taylor left the suite and walked down the corridor. Suddenly, Rashid yelled,
"I thought you were dead!"
and broke into a run. Then Taylor saw Paul and Bill. Rashid was hugging them both, screaming,
"I couldn't find you! I couldn't find you!"
Taylor ran up and embraced Paul and Bill.
"Thank God," he said.
Rashid ran back into Gayden's suite, yelling,
"Paul and Bill are here! Paul and Bill are here!"
An instant later, Paul and Bill walked in, and all hell broke loose.
Chapter 10. It was an unforgettable moment. Everyone was yelling, no one was listening, and they all wanted to hug Paul and Bill at the same time. Gayden was bellowing into the phone, "We got the guys! We got the guys! Fantastic! They just walked in the door! Fantastic!" Somebody yelled, "We beat them! We beat those sons of bitches! We did it! In your ear, Dadgar!" Buffy barked like a mad thing. Paul looked around at his friends and realized that they had stayed here in the middle of a revolution to help him, and he found he had difficulty speaking. Gayden dropped the phone and came over to shake hands. Paul, with tears in his eyes, said, "Gayden, I just saved you $12.5 million. I think you ought to buy me a drink." Gayden fixed him a stiff scotch. Paul tasted his first alcoholic drink for 6 weeks. Gayden said into the phone, "I have somebody would like to speak to you." He handed the phone to Paul. Paul said, "Hello." He heard the syrupy voice of Tom Walter. "Hi there, buddy." "God almighty," said Paul, out of general exhaustion and relief. "We were wondering where you guys were." "So was I for the last 3 hours. How did you get to the hotel, Paul?" Paul did not have the energy to tell Walter the whole story. "Fortunately, Keene left me a lot of money one day." "Fantastic. Golly, Paul. Is Bill okay?" "Yep, he's a little shook up, but he's all right." "We're all a little shook up. Oh, boy. Boy, it's good to hear you." Another voice came on the line. "Paul, this is Mitch." Mitch Hart was a former president of EDS. "I figured that Italian street fighter would get out of there." "How's Ruthie?" said Paul. Tom Walter answered. "They must be using the telephone conference circuit," Paul guessed. "Paul, she's great. I just talked to her a little while ago. Jean's calling her right now. She's on the other phone." "Kid's doing all right?" "Yeah, fine. Boy, she'll be glad to hear." "Okay, I'll let you talk to my other half." Paul handed the phone to Bill. While he had been speaking, an Iranian employee, Holam, had arrived. He had heard about the jailbreak and had gone looking for Paul and Bill in the streets around the prison. Jay Coburn was worried by the arrival of Holam. For a few minutes there, Coburn had been too full of tearful joy to think of anything else, but now he reverted to his role as Simon's lieutenant. He quietly left the suite, found another open door, went into the room, and called the Devoronchik apartment. Simons answered the phone. "It's Jay. They got here." "Good. The security is all shot to hell here. They're using the names over the phone. Everybody's wandering around. We have Iranian employees walking in. Get a couple of rooms away from the others. We'll be right there." "Okay." Coburn hung up. He went down to the reception desk and asked for a two-bedroom suite on the 12th floor. There was no problem. The hotel had hundreds of empty rooms. He gave a false name. He was not asked for his passport. He returned to Gayden's suite. A few minutes later, Simons walked in and said, "Hang up the goddamn phone." Bob Young, who was holding the line open to Dallas, put down the phone. Joe Poche walked in behind Simons and started closing the curtains. It was incredible. Suddenly, Simons was in charge. Gayden, the president of EDS World, was the senior man there, and an hour ago he had told Tom Walter that the Sunshine Boys, Simons, Coburn, and Poche, seemed useless and ineffectual, yet now he deferred to Simons without even thinking about it. "Take a look around, Joe," Simons said to Poche. Coburn knew what this meant. The team had scouted the hotel and its grounds during their weeks of waiting, and Poche would now see whether there had been any changes. The phone rang. John Howell answered it. "It's Abul Hassan," he said to the others. He listened for a couple of minutes, then said, "Hold on." He covered the mouthpiece with his hand and spoke to Simons. "This is an Iranian employee who translates for me at meetings with Dadgar. His father is a friend of Dadgar's. He's at his father's house and just got a call from Dadgar." The room went very quiet. Dadgar said, "Did you know the Americans are out of jail?" Abul Hassan said, "It's news to me." Dadgar said, "Get hold of EDS and tell them that if they find Chaperone and Gaylord, they are to turn them in, that I'm now willing to renegotiate the bail and it ought to be much more reasonable." Gayden said, "Fuck him." "All right," Simon said. "Tell Abul Hassan to give Dadgar a message. Say we are searching for Paul and Bill, but meanwhile, we hold Dadgar personally responsible for their safety. Howell smiled and nodded and began speaking to Abel Hassan. Simons turned to Gaydon. Call the American embassy. Yell at them a little. They got Paul and Bill thrown in jail. Now the jail has been stormed, and we don't know where Paul and Bill are, but we hold the embassy responsible for their safety. Make it convincing. There must be Iranian spies at the embassy. You can bet your ass Dadgar will have the text of the message in minutes. Gaydon went to find a phone. Simons, Coburn, and Poche, with Paul and Bill, moved to the new suite Coburn had taken on the floor above. Coburn ordered 2 steak dinners for Paul and Bill. He told room service to send them to Gaydon's suite. There was to be no unnecessary traffic in and out of the new rooms. Paul took a hot bath. He had been longing for it. He had not had a bath for 6 weeks. He reveled in the clean white bathroom, the piping hot water, the fresh cake of soap. He would never take such things for granted again. He watched the gossip prison out of his hair. There were clean clothes waiting for him. Someone had retrieved his suitcase from the Hilton, where he had been staying until he was arrested. Bill took a shower. His euphoria had gone. He had imagined that the nightmare was over when he walked into Gaydon's suite. But gradually it had dawned on him that he was still in danger. There was no U.S. Air Force jet waiting to fly him home at twice the speed of sound. Dadgar's message via Abel Hassan, the appearance of Simons, and the new security precautions, the suite, Poche closing the curtains, the shuttling of the food, all made him realize that the escape had only just begun. All the same, he enjoyed his steak dinner. Simons was still uneasy. The Hyatt was near the Evan Hotel where the U.S. military stayed, the Avine prison, and an armory. All these were natural targets for the revolutionaries. Dadgar's phone call was also worrying. Plenty of Iranians knew that the EDS people were staying at the Hyatt. Dadgar could easily find out and send men to search for Paul and Bill. While Simons, Coburn, and Bill were discussing this in the sitting room of the suite, the phone rang. Simons stared at it. It rang again. "Who the fuck knows we're here?" Simons said. Coburn shrugged. Simons picked up the phone and said, "Hello?" There was a pause. "Hello?" He hung up. Nobody there. At that moment, Paul walked in his pajamas. Simons said, "Change your clothes. We're going to leave." "Why?" Paul protested. Simons repeated, "Change your clothes. We're going to leave." Paul shrugged and went back into the bedroom. Bill found it hard to believe. On the run again already? Somehow Dadgar was staying in authority through all the violence and chaos of the revolution. But who was working for him? The guards had fled the jails, the police stations had been burned, the army had surrendered. Who was left to carry out Dadgar's orders? The devil and all his hordes, Bill thought. Simons went down to Gaydon's suite while Paul was dressing. He got Gaydon and Taylor in a corner. "Get all these turkeys out of here," he said in a low voice. "The story is, Paul and Bill are in bed for the night. You'll all come to our place tomorrow morning. Leave at 7 o'clock, just as if you were going to the office. Don't pack any bags, don't check out, don't pay your hotel bill. Joe Poche will be waiting for you outside, and he'll have figured out a safe route to the house. I'm taking Paul and Bill there now, but don't tell the others that until the morning." "Okay," said Gaydon. Simons went back upstairs. Paul and Bill were ready. Coburn and Poche were waiting. The five of them walked to the elevator. As they were going down, Simons said, "Now, let's just walk out of here like it was the normal thing to do." They reached the ground floor. They walked across the vast lobby and out into the forecourt. The 2 Range Rovers were parked there. As they crossed the forecourt, a big dark car drew up and 4 or 5 ragged men with machine guns jumped out. Coburn muttered, "Oh, shit." The 5 Americans kept walking. The revolutionaries ran over to the doorman. Poche threw open the doors of the 1st Range Rover. Paul and Bill jumped in. Poche started the engine and pulled away fast. Simons and Coburn got into the 2nd car and followed. The revolutionaries went into the hotel. Poche headed down the Vanak Highway, which passed both the Hyatt and the Hilton. They could hear constant machine gun fire over the sound of the car engines. A mile up the road, at the intersection with Pahlavi Avenue near the Hilton, they ran into a roadblock. Poche pulled up. Bill looked around. He and Paul had come through this intersection a few hours earlier with the Iranian couple who had brought them to the Hyatt. But then there had been no roadblock, just 1 burned-out car. Now there were several burning cars, a barricade, and a crowd of revolutionaries armed with an assortment of military firearms. One of them approached the Range Rover, and Joe Poche rolled down the window. "Where are you going?" the revolutionary said in perfect English. "I'm going to my mother-in-law's house in Abbas Abad," Poche said. Bill thought, "My God, what an idiotic story to tell." Paul was looking away, hiding his face. Another revolutionary came up and spoke in Farsi. The first man said, "Do you have any cigarettes?" "No, I don't smoke," said Poche. "Okay, go ahead." Poche drove on down the Shahanshahi Expressway. Coburn pulled the 2nd car forward to where the revolutionary stood. "Are you with them?" he was asked. "Yes." "Do you have any cigarettes?" "Yes." Coburn took a pack out of his pocket and tried to shake out a cigarette. His hands were unsteady, and he could not get one out. Simon said, "Jay." "Yes?" "Give him the fucking pack." Coburn gave the revolutionary the whole pack, and he waved them on.
Ruthie Chiaperoni was in bed, but awake, at the Neifler's house in Dallas when the phone rang. She heard footsteps in the hall. The ringing stopped, and Jim Neifler's voice said, "Hello?" "Well, she's sleeping." "I'm awake," Ruthie called. She got out of bed, slipped on a robe, and went into the hall. "It's Tom Walter's wife, Jean," said Jim, handing her the phone. Ruthie said, "Hi, Jean." "Ruth, I have good news for you. The guys are free. They got out of jail." "Oh, thank God," said Ruthie. She had not yet begun to wonder how Paul would get out of Iran. When Emily Gaylord got back from church, her mother said, "Tom Walter called from Dallas. I said you'd call back." Emily snatched up the phone, dialed EDS's number, and asked for Walter. "Hi, Emily," Walter drawled. "Paul and Bill got out of jail." "Tom, that's wonderful." "There was a jailbreak. They're safe, and they're in good hands." "When are they coming home?" "We're not sure yet, but we'll keep you posted." "Thank you, Tom," said Emily. "Thank you."
Ross Perot was in bed with Margot. The phone woke them both. Perot reached out and picked it up. "Yes?" "Ross, this is Tom Walter. Paul and Bill got out of jail." Suddenly, Perot was wide awake. He sat up. "That's great." Margot said sleepily, "They're out?" "Yes." She smiled. "Oh, good." Tom Walter was saying, "The jail was overrun by the revolutionaries, and Paul and Bill walked out." Perot's mind was clicking into gear. "Where are they now?" "At the hotel." "That's dangerous, Tom. Is Simons there?" When I was talking to them, he was not there." "Tell them to call him. Taylor knows the number. And get them out of that hotel." "Yes, sir." "Call everyone into the office right away. I'll be there in a few minutes." "Yes, sir." Perot hung up. He got out of bed, threw on some clothes, kissed Margot, and ran down the stairs. He went through the kitchen and out the back door. A security man, surprised to see him up so early, said, "Good morning, Mr. Perot." "Morning." Perot decided to take Margot's Jaguar. He jumped in and raced down the driveway to the gate. For 6 weeks, he had felt as if he were living inside a popcorn popper. He had been trying everything, and nothing had worked. Bad news had hit him from every direction. He had made no progress. Now, at last, things were moving. He tore along Forest Lane, running red lights and breaking the speed limit. Getting them out of jail was the easy part, he reflected. Now we have to get them out of Iran. The hard part hasn't even started. In the next few minutes, the whole team gathered at EDS headquarters on Forest Lane. Tom Walter, T.J. Marquez, Merv Stauffer, Perot's secretary, Sally Walther, lawyer Tom Luce, and Mitch Hart, who, though he no longer worked at EDS, had been trying to use his connections in the Democratic Party to help Paul and Bill. Until now, communications with a negotiating team in Tehran had been organized from Bill Gayden's office on the fifth floor, while on the seventh floor, Merv Stauffer was quietly handling support and communications with the illegal rescue team, talking on the phone in code. Now they all realized that Simons was the key figure in Tehran, and that whatever happened next would probably be illegal. So they moved up to Stauffer's office, which was also more private. "I'm going to go to Washington right away," Perot told them. "Our best hope is still an Air Force jet out of Tehran." Stauffer said, "I don't know about flights to Washington from DFW on Sundays." "Charter a jet," Perot said. Stauffer picked up the phone. "We're going to need secretaries here 24 hours a day for the next few days," Perot went on. "I'll see to that," said TJ. "Now, the military has promised to help us, but we can't rely on them. They may have bigger fish to fry. The likeliest alternative is for the team to drive out via Turkey. In that event, the plan is for us to meet them at the border, or if necessary, fly into the northwest of Iran to pull them out. We need to assemble the Turkish rescue team. Bulwer is already in Istanbul. Schwabach, Scully, and Davis are in the States. Somebody call them and have the three of them meet me in Washington. We may also need a helicopter pilot and another pilot for small fixed-wing aircraft, in case we want to sneak into Iran. Sally, call Margot and ask her to pack me a case. I'll need casual clothes, a flashlight, all-weather boots, thermal underwear, a sleeping bag, and a tent." "Yes, sir." Sally left the room. "Ross, I don't think that's a good idea," TJ said. "Margot might get scared." Perot suppressed a sigh. It was just like TJ to argue, but he was right. "Okay, I'll go home and do it myself. Come with me so we can talk while I'm packing." "Sure." Stauffer put down the phone and said, "There's a Learjet waiting for you at Love Field." "Good." Perot and TJ went downstairs and got in their cars. They left EDS and turned right on Forest Lane. A few seconds later, TJ looked at his speedometer and saw that he was doing 80, and Perot, in Margot's Jaguar, was losing him. At Page Terminal in Washington, Perot ran into two old friends, Bill Clements, governor of Texas, and former deputy secretary of defense, and Clements' wife, Rita. Clements said, "Hi, Ross. What the hell are you doing in Washington on a Sunday afternoon?" "I'm up here on business," said Perot. "Now, what are you doing, really?" said Clements with a grin. "Have you got a minute?" Clements had a minute. The three of them sat down, and Perot told the story of Paul and Bill. When he had finished, Clements said, There's a guy you need to talk to. I'll write down his name. How am I going to get him on a Sunday afternoon? Hell, I'll get him. The two men walked over to a payphone. Clemens put in a coin, called the Pentagon switchboard, and identified himself. He asked to be put through to the home of one of the most senior military officers in the country. Then he said, I've got Ross Perot from Texas with me. He's a friend of mine and a good friend to the military, and I want you to help him. Then he handed the phone to Perot and walked away. Half an hour later, Perot was in an operations room in the Pentagon basement, surrounded by computer terminals, talking to a half a dozen generals. He had never met any of them before, but he felt he was among friends. They all knew of his campaign for the American prisoners of war in North Vietnam. I want to get two men out of Tehran, Perot told them. Can you fly them out? No, said one of the generals. We're grounded in Tehran. Our airbase, Doshen Tope, is in the hands of the revolutionaries. General Gast is in the bunker beneath MAAG headquarters, surrounded by a mob. And we have no communications because the phone lines have been cut. Okay, said Perot. He had half expected that answer. I'm going to have to do it myself. It's on the other side of the world, and there's a revolution going on, said a general. It won't be easy. Perot smiled. I have Bull Simons over there. They broke up. Damn it, Perot, said one of them. You aren't giving the Iranians an even chance. Right, Perot grinned. I may have to fly in myself. Now, can you give me a list of all the airfields between Tehran and the Turkish border? Sure. Could you find out whether any of those airfields are obstructed? We can just look at the satellite photographs. Now, what about radar? Is there a way to fly in there without appearing on the Iranians' radar screens? Sure. We'll get you a radar map at 500 feet. Good. Anything else? Hell, Perot thought. This is just like going into McDonald's. That'll do for now, he said. The general started pushing buttons. T.J. Marquez picked up the phone. It was Perot. I got your pilots, T.J. told him. I call Larry Joseph. He used to be head of Continental Air Services in Vientiane, Laos. He's in Washington now. He found the guys, Dick Douglas and Julian Canock. They'll be in Washington tomorrow. That's great, said Perot. Now, I've been to the Pentagon, and they can't fly the guys out. They're grounded in Tehran. But I have all kinds of maps and stuff, so we can fly in ourselves. Now, this is what I need. A jet plane, capable of crossing the Atlantic, complete with a crew and equipped with a single sideband radio, like we used to have in Laos, so we can make phone calls from the plane. I'll get right on it, said TJ. I'm at the Madison Hotel. Got it. TJ started calling. He contacted two Texas charter companies. Neither of them had a transatlantic jet. The second, Jet Fleet, gave him the name of executive aircraft out of Columbus, Ohio. They could not help, and they did not know of anyone who could. TJ thought of Europe. He called Carl Nielsen, an EDS executive who had been working on a proposal for Martin Air. Nielsen called back and said Martin Air would not fly into Iran, but had given him the name of a Swiss outfit who would. TJ called Switzerland. That company had stopped flying into Iran as of today. TJ dialed the number of Harry McKillop, a Braniff vice president who lived in Paris. McKillop was out. TJ called Perot and confessed failure. Perot had an idea. He seemed to remember that Saul Rogers, the president of Texas State Optical Company down in Beaumont, had either a BAC-111 or a Boeing 727. He was not sure which. Nor did he have the phone number. TJ called information. The number was unlisted. He called Margot. She had the number. He called Rogers. He had sold his plane. Rogers knew of an outfit called Omni International in Washington, which leased planes. He gave TJ the home phone numbers of the president and vice president. TJ called the president. He was out. He called the vice president. He was in. Do you have a transatlantic jet? TJ asked. Sure, we have two. TJ breathed a sigh of relief. We have a 707 and a 727, the man went on. Where? The 707 is at Meacham Field in Fort Worth. Why, that's right here, said TJ. Now tell me, does it have a single sideband radio? Sure does. TJ could hardly believe his luck. This plane is rather luxuriously fitted out, the vice president said. It was done for a Kuwaiti prince who backed out. TJ was not interested in the decor. He asked about the price. The vice president said the president would have to make the final decision. He was out for the evening, but TJ could call him first thing in the morning. TJ had the plane checked out by Jeff Heller, an EDS vice president and former Vietnam pilot, and two of Heller's friends, one an American Airlines pilot and the other a flight engineer. Heller reported that the plane seemed to be in good shape, as far as they could tell without flying it. The decor was kind of overripe, he said with a smile. At 7:30 the following morning, TJ called the president of Omni and got him out of the shower. The president had talked to his vice president, and he was sure they could do business. Good, said TJ. Now what about crew, ground facilities, insurance? We don't charter planes, said the president. We lease them. What's the difference? It's like the difference between taking a cab and renting a car. Our planes are for rent. Look, we're in the computer business. We know nothing about airlines, said TJ. Even though you normally don't do it, will you make a deal with us where you supply all the extras, crew and so on? We'll pay you for it. Look, we're in the computer business. We know nothing about airlines, said TJ. Even though you normally don't do it, will you make a deal with us where you supply all the extras, crew and so on? We'll pay you for it. It'll be complicated, the insurance alone. But you'll do it? Yes, we'll do it. It was complicated, TJ learned during the course of the day. The unusual nature of the deal did not appeal to the insurance companies, who also hated to be hurried. It was hard to figure out which regulations EDS needed to comply with, since they were not an airline. Omni required a deposit of $60,000 in an offshore branch of a U.S. bank. The problems were solved by EDS executive Gary Fernandez in Washington and EDS house lawyer Claude Chapelier in Dallas. The contract, which was executed at the end of the day, was a sales demonstration lease. Omni found a crew in California and sent them to Dallas to pick up the plane and fly it on to Washington. By midnight on Monday, the plane, the crew, the extra pilots, and the remnants of the rescue team were all in Washington with Ross Perot. TJ had worked a miracle. That was why it took so long.
The negotiating team, Keene Taylor, Bill Gayden, John Howell, Bob Young, and Rich Gallagher, augmented now by Rashid, Kathy Gallagher, and the dog, Buffy, spent the night of Sunday, February 11th at the Hyatt. They got little sleep. Close by, the mob was attacking an armory. It seemed part of the army had now joined the revolution, for tanks were used in the attack. Toward morning, they blew a hole in the wall and got in. From dawn on, a stream of orange cabs ferried weapons from the armory downtown to where the fighting was still heavy. The team kept the line to Dallas open all night. John Howell lay on the couch in Gayden's sitting room with the phone to his ear. In the morning, Rashid left early. He was not told where the others were going. No Iranians were to know the location of the hideout. The others packed their suitcases and left them in their rooms, just in case they should get the chance to pick them up later. This was not part of Simon's instructions, and he would certainly have disapproved, for the packed bag showed that the EDS people were no longer living here. But by morning, they all felt Simon's was overdoing his security precautions. They gathered in Gayden's sitting room a few minutes after the 7 o'clock deadline. The Gallaghers had several bags, and did not really look as if they were going to the office. In the foyer, they met the hotel manager. "Where are you going?" he asked incredulously. "To the office," Gayden told him. "Don't you know there's a civil war going on out there? All night long, we've been feeding the revolutionaries out of our kitchens. They asked if there were any Americans here. I told them there was nobody here. You must go back upstairs and stay out of sight." "Life must go on," said Gayden, and they all walked out. Joe Pache was waiting in a Range Rover, silently fuming because they were 15 minutes late, and he had instructions from Simons to be back at 7:45, with or without them. As they walked to the cars, Keene Taylor saw a hotel clerk drive in and park. He went over to speak to the man. "How are the streets?" "Roadblocks all over the place," said the clerk. "There's one right here at the end of the hotel driveway. You shouldn't go out." "Thank you," said Taylor. They all got into the cars and followed Pochet's Range Rover. The guards at the gate were preoccupied, trying to jam a banana clip into a machine pistol that did not take that kind of ammunition, and they paid no attention to the three cars. The scene outside was scary. Many of the weapons from the armory had found their way into the hands of teenage boys who had probably never handled firearms before, and the kids were running down the hill yelling and waving their guns and jumping into cars to tear off along the highways, shooting into the air. Pache headed north on Shahan Shahi, following a roundabout route to avoid roadblocks. At the intersection with Pahlavi, there was the remains of a barricade, burned cars and tree trunks across the road, but the people manning the roadblock were celebrating, chanting and firing into the air, and the three cars drove straight through. As they approached the hideout, they entered a relatively quiet area. They turned into a narrow street. Then, half a block down, they drove through the gates into a walled garden with an empty swimming pool. The Dvoranchik place was the bottom half of a duplex with a landlady living upstairs. They all went in. During Monday, Dadgar continued to search for Paul and Bill. Bill Gayden called Bucharest, where a skeleton staff of loyal Iranians continued to man the phones. Gayden learned that Dadgar's men had called twice, speaking to two different secretaries, and asked where they could find Mr. Schiaparoni and Mr. Gaylord. The first secretary had said she did not know the names of the Americans, which was a brave lie. She had been working for EDS for 4 years and knew everyone. The second secretary had said, "You will have to speak to Mr. Lloyd Briggs, who is in charge of the office."
"Where is he?"
"Out of the country."
"Well, who is in charge of the office in his absence?"
"Mr. Keene Taylor."
"Let me speak to him."
"He's not here right now."
The girls, bless them, had given Dadgar's men the runaround. Rich Gallagher was keeping in touch with his friends in the military. Kathy had a job as secretary to a colonel.
He called the Evan Hotel, where most of the military were staying, and learned that the revolutionaries had gone to both the Evan and the Hyatt, showing photographs of two Americans for whom they were looking. Dadgar's tenacity was almost incredible. Simons decided they could not stay at the Dvorantchik house more than 48 hours. The escape plan had been devised for 5 men. There were now 10 men, a woman, and a dog. They had only 2 Range Rovers. An ordinary car would never take those mountain roads, especially in snow. They needed another Range Rover. Coburn called Majid and asked him to try to get one. The dog worried Simons. Rich Gallagher was planning to carry Buffy in a knapsack. If they had to walk or ride horseback through the mountains to cross the border, a single yap could get them all killed. And Buffy barked at everything. Simons said to Coburn and Taylor, "I want you two to lose that fucking dog." "Okay," Coburn said. "Maybe I'll offer to walk it and then just let it go." "No," said Simons. "When I say lose it, I mean permanently." Kathy was the biggest problem. That evening she felt ill. Feminine problems, Rich said. He was hoping that a day in bed would leave her feeling stronger, but Simons was not optimistic. He fumed at the embassy. "There are so many ways the State Department could get someone out of the country and protect them if they wanted to," he said. "Put them in a case, ship them out as cargo. If they were interested, it would be a snap." Bill began to feel like the cause of all the trouble. "I think it's insane for 9 people to risk their lives for the sake of 2," he said. "If Paul and I weren't here, none of you would be in any danger. You could just wait until the flights out resume. Maybe Paul and I should throw ourselves in the mercy of the U.S. Embassy." Simon said, "And what if you 2 get out? Then that guy decides to take other hostages." Anyway, Coburn thought, Simons won't let those 2 out of his sight now, not until they're back in the USA. The bell at the street gate rang and everybody froze. "Move into the bedrooms, but quietly," Simon said. Coburn went to the window. The landlady still thought there were only 2 people living here, Coburn and Pochet. She had never seen Simons, and neither she nor anyone else was supposed to know that there were now 11 people in the house. As Coburn watched, she walked across the courtyard and opened the gate. She stood there for a few minutes, talking to someone Coburn could not see, then closed the gate and came back alone. When he heard her door slam shut upstairs, he called, "False alarm!" They all prepared for the journey by looting the Dvorantchik place for warm clothes. Paul thought, Tony Dvorantchik would die of embarrassment if she knew about all these men going through her drawers. They ended up with a peculiar assortment of ill-fitting hats, coats, and sweaters. After that, they had nothing to do but wait. Wait for Majid to find another Range Rover, wait for Kathy to get better, and wait for Perot to get the Turkish rescue team organized. They watched some old football games on the Betamax video. Paul played gin with Gayden. The dog got on everyone's nerves, but Coburn decided not to slit its throat until the last minute, in case there was a change of plan and it could be saved. John Howell read The Deep by Peter Benchley. He had seen part of the movie on the flight over and missed the ending because the plane landed before the movie finished, and he had never figured out who were the good guys and who were the bad guys. Simon said, "Those who wish to drink can do so, but if we have to move fast, we'll be much better without any alcohol in our systems." But despite the warning, both Gayden and Gallagher surreptitiously mixed Drambuie with their coffee. The bell rang once more, and they all went through the same routine, but again, it was for the landlady. They were all remarkably good-tempered, considering how many of them were crammed into the living room and 3 bedrooms of the place. The only one to get irritable was, predictably, Keen Taylor. He and Paul cooked a big dinner for everyone, almost emptying the freezer. But by the time Taylor came in from the kitchen, the others had eaten every scrap and there was nothing for him. He cursed them all roundly for a bunch of greedy hogs, and they all laughed the way they always did when Taylor got mad. During the night, he got mad again. He was sleeping on the floor next to Coburn, and Coburn snored. The noise was so awful that Taylor could not get to sleep. He could not even wake Coburn to tell him to stop snoring, and that made him even madder.
It was snowing in Washington that night. Ross Perot was tired and tense. With Mitch Hart, he had spent most of the day in a last-ditch effort to persuade the government to fly his people out of Tehran. He had seen Undersecretary David Newsom at the State Department, Thomas V. Beard at the White House, and Mark Ginsburg, a young Carter aide whose job was liaison between the White House and the State Department. They were doing their best to arrange to fly the remaining 1,000 Americans out of Tehran, and they were not about to make special plans for Ross Perot. Resigned to going to Turkey, Perot went to a sporting goods store and bought himself cold-weather clothes. The Lee 707 arrived from Dallas, and Pat Scully called from Dulles Airport to say that some mechanical problems had surfaced during the flight. The transponder and the inertial navigation system did not work properly. The No. 1 engine was using oil at twice the normal rate. There was insufficient oxygen aboard for cabin use, there were no spare tires, and the water tank valves were frozen solid. While mechanics worked on the plane, Perot sat in the Madison Hotel with Mort Meyerson, a vice president of EDS. At EDS, there was a special group of Perot associates, men such as T.J. Marquez and Merv Stauffer, to whom he turned for help with matters that were not part of the day-to-day business of computer software. Schemes like the Prisoners of War campaign, the Texas War on Drugs, and the rescue of Paul and Bill. Although Meyerson did not get involved in Perot's special projects, he was fully informed about the rescue plan and had given it his blessing. He knew Paul and Bill well, having worked alongside them in earlier years as a systems engineer. For business matters, he was Perot's top man, and he would soon become president of EDS. Perot would continue to be chairman of the board. Now, Perot and Meyerson talked business, reviewing each of EDS's current projects and problems. Both knew, though neither said, that the reason for the conference was that Perot might never come back from Turkey. In some ways, the two men were as different as chalk and cheese. Meyerson's grandfather was a Russian Jew who had saved for 2 years to buy his rail ticket from New York to Texas. Meyerson's interests ranged from athletics to the arts. He played handball, was involved with the Dallas Symphony Orchestra, and was himself a good pianist. Making fun of Perot and his Eagles, Meyerson called his own close colleagues Meyerson's Toads. But in many ways, he was like Perot, a creative and daring businessman whose bold ideas often scared more conventional executives in EDS. Perot had given instructions that if something were to happen to him during the rescue, all his stock would be voted by Meyerson. EDS would continue to be run by a leader, not a bureaucrat. While Perot discussed business and worried about the plane and fumed against the State Department, his deepest concern was for his mother. Lulu May Perot was sinking fast, and Perot wanted to be with her. If she were to die while he was in Turkey, he would never see her again, and that would break his heart. Meyerson knew what was on his mind. He broke off the business talk to say, "Russ, why don't I go?" "What do you mean?" "Why don't I go to Turkey instead of you? You've done your share. You went to Iran. There's nothing you can do that I can't do in Turkey. And you want to stay with your mother." Perot was touched. Mort didn't have to say that, he thought. "If you're willing," he was tempted. "That's something I'd sure want to think about. Let me think about it." He was not sure he had the right to let Meyerson do this instead of him. "Let's see what the others think." He picked up the phone, called Dallas, and reached T.J. Marquez. "Mort's offered to go to Turkey instead of me," he told T.J. "What's your reaction to that?" "It's the worst idea in the world," T.J. said. "You've been close to this project from the start, and you couldn't possibly tell Mort everything he needs to know in a few hours. You know Simons. You know how his mind works. Mort doesn't. Plus, Simons doesn't know Mort, and you're aware of how Simons feels about trusting people he doesn't know. Well, he won't trust them. That's how he feels." "You're right," Perot said. "It's not for consideration." He hung up. "Mort, I sure appreciate your offer, but I'm going to Turkey." "Whatever you say." A few minutes later, Meyerson left to return to Dallas in the chartered Learjet. Perot called EDS again and spoke to Merv Stauffer. "Now, I want you guys to work in shifts and get some sleep," Perot said. "I don't want to be talking to a bunch of zombies back there." "Yes, sir." Perot took his own advice and got some sleep. The phone woke him at 2 a.m. It was Pat Scully calling from the airport. The plane's mechanical problems were fixed. Perot got a cab to Dulles Airport. It was a hair-raising 30-mile ride on icy roads. The Turkish rescue team was now together, Perot, Pat Scully, and Jim Schwabach. The deadly duo, young Ron Davis, the crew of the 707, and the two extra pilots, Dick Douglas and Julian Scratch Cannock. But the plane was not mended. It needed a spare part that was not available in Washington. Gary Fernandez, the EDS manager who had worked on the leasing contract for the plane, had a friend who was in charge of ground support for one of the airlines at New York's LaGuardia Airport. He called the friend, and the friend got out of bed, found the part, and put it on a plane for Washington. Meanwhile, Perot lay down on a bench in the terminal and slept for a couple more hours. They boarded at 6 a.m. Perot looked around the interior of the aircraft in amazement. It had a bedroom with a king-size bed, three bars, a sophisticated hi-fi system, a television, and an office with a phone. There were plush carpets, suede upholstery, and velvet walls. "It looks like a Persian whorehouse," said Perot, although he had never seen a Persian whorehouse. The plane took off. Dick Douglas and Scratch Cannock immediately curled up and went to sleep. Perot tried to follow their example. He had 16 hours of nothing to do in front of him. As the plane headed out across the Atlantic Ocean, he wondered again whether he was doing the right thing. He might, after all, have left Paul and Bill to take their chances in Tehran. Nobody would have blamed him. It was the government's job to rescue them. Indeed, the embassy might even now be able to get them out unharmed. On the other hand, Dadgar might pick them up and throw them in jail for 20 years, and the embassy, on past performance, might not protect them. And what would the revolutionaries do if they got hold of Paul and Bill? Lynch them? No, Perot could not leave his men to take their chances. It was not his way. Paul and Bill were his responsibility. He did not need his mother to tell him that. The trouble was that he was now putting more men at risk. Instead of having two people hiding in Tehran, he would now have 11 employees on the run in the wilds of northwest Iran, and another four plus two pilots searching for them. If things went wrong, if someone got killed, The world would see this whole thing as a foolhardy adventure by a man who thought he was still living in the Wild West. He could imagine the newspaper headlines. Millionaire Texan's Iran rescue bid ends in death. Suppose we lose Coburn, he thought. What would I tell his wife? Liz might find it hard to understand why I staked the lives of 17 men to gain the freedom of two. He had never broken the law in his life, and now he was involved in so many major illegal activities he could not count them. He put all that out of his mind. The decision was made. If you go through life thinking about all the bad things that can happen, you soon talk yourself into doing nothing at all. Concentrate on the problems that can be solved. The chips are on the table, and the wheel is in spin. The last game has begun.
On Tuesday, the U.S. Embassy announced that evacuation flights for all Americans in Tehran would leave during the coming weekend. Simons got Coburn and Bechet in one of the bedrooms of the Dvoranchek place and closed the door. "This solves some of our problems," he said. "I want to split them up at this point in the game. Some could take the embassy evacuation flight, leaving a manageable group for the overland trip." Coburn and Bechet agreed. "Obviously, Paul and Bill have to go overland," Simons said. "Two of us three have to go with them, one to escort them across the mountains, and the other to cross the border legitimately and meet up with Bulwer. We'll need an Iranian driver for each of the two Range Rovers. That leaves us two spare seats. Who takes them? Not Kathy. She'll be much better off on the embassy flight."
"Rich will want to go with her," said Coburn.
"And that fucking dog?" Simons added.
Buffy's life is saved, Coburn thought. He was rather glad. Simons said,
"There's Keen Taylor, John Howell, Bob Young, and Bill Gayton. Here's the problem. Dad guy might pick up people at the airport, and we'll end up back where we started, with EDS men in jail. Who is at most risk?"
"Gayton," said Coburn. "He's president of EDS World. As a hostage, he'd be better than Paul and Bill. In fact, when Dadgar arrested Bill Gaylord, we wondered whether it was a mistake, and he really wanted Bill Gayden, but he got confused because of the similarity of the names. Gayton comes out overland with Paul and Bill, then. John Howell is not even employed by EDS, and he's a lawyer. He should be all right. Howell goes out by air. Bob Young is employed by EDS in Kuwait, not Iran. If Dadgar has a list of EDS names, Young won't be on it. Young flies, Taylor drives. Now, one of us has to go on the evacuation flight with the clean team. Joe, that's you. You've kept a lower profile than Jay. He's been on the streets, at meetings, at the Hyatt, whereas nobody knows you're here."
"Okay," said Bechet.
"So the clean team is the Gallaghers, Bob Young, and John Howell, led by Joe. The dirty team is me, Jay, Keen Taylor, Bill Gayden, Paul, Bill, and two Iranian drivers. Let's go tell them." They went into the living room and got everyone sat down. As Simons talked, Coburn admired how he announced his decision in such a way that they all thought they were being asked for their opinions rather than being told what to do. There was some discussion of who should be in which team. Both John Howell and Bob Young would have preferred to be in the dirty team, feeling themselves vulnerable to arrest by Dadgar, but in the end they all reached the decision Simons had already made. "The clean team might as well move into the embassy compound as soon as possible," Simons said. Gayden and Joe Bechet went off to find Lou Goltz, the consul general, and talk to him about it. The dirty team would leave tomorrow morning. Coburn had to organize the Iranian drivers. These were to have been Majid and his cousin, the professor, but the professor was in Rezaieh and could not get to Tehran, so Coburn had to find a replacement. He had already decided on Sayayed. Sayayed was a young Iranian systems engineer, like Rashid and the Cycle Man, but from a much wealthier family. Relatives of his had been high in politics and the army under the Shah. Sayayed had been educated in England and spoke with a British accent. His great asset, from Coburn's point of view, was that he came from the northwest, so he knew the territory and he spoke Turkish. Coburn called Sayayed, and they met at Sayayed's house. Coburn told him lies.
"I need to gather intelligence on the roads between here and Hoy," Coburn said. "I'll need someone to drive me. Will you do it?"
"Sure," said Sayayed.
"Meet me at 10:45 tonight at Argentine Square."
Sayayed agreed. Simons had instructed Coburn to go through all this. Coburn trusted Sayayed, but of course Simons did not. So Sayayed would not know where the team was staying until he got there, and he would not know about Paul and Bill until he saw them. And from that moment on, he would not be out of Simons' sight. When Coburn returned to the Dvoranchek place, Gayden and Bechet were back from seeing Lou Goltz. They had told Goltz that a few EDS men were staying in Tehran to look for Paul and Bill, but the others wanted to leave on the first evacuation flight and stay at the embassy in the meantime. Goltz had said the embassy was full, but they could stay at his house. They all thought this was pretty damn good of Goltz. Most of them had gotten mad at him once or twice over the last 2 months, and had made it pretty clear that they blamed him and his colleagues for the arrest of Paul and Bill. It was big of him to open his house to them after all that. As everything came unglued in Iran, Goltz was becoming less of a bureaucrat and showing his heart was in the right place. The clean team and the dirty team shook hands and wished each other luck, not knowing who needed it most. Then the clean team left for Goltz's house. It was now evening. Coburn and Keen Taylor went to Majid's house to pick him up. he would spend the night at the Duranchek place, like Sayed. Coburn and Taylor also had to get a 55-gallon drum of fuel that Majid had been keeping for them. When they got to the house, Majid was out. They waited, fretting. At last, Majid came in. He greeted them, welcomed them to his house, called for tea, the whole nine yards. Eventually, Coburn said, "We're leaving tomorrow morning. We want you to come with us now." Majid asked Coburn to step into another room with him. Then he said, "I can't go with you." "Why not?" "I have to kill Hoyvayada." "What?" said Coburn incredulously. "Who?" "Amir Abbas Hoyvayada, who used to be prime minister." "Why do you have to kill him?" "It's a long story. The Shah had a land reform program, and Hoyvayada tried to take away my family's tribal lands, and we rebelled, and Hoyvayada put me in jail. I've been waiting all these years for my revenge." "You have to kill him right away?" said Coburn, astonished. "I have the weapons and the opportunity. In 2 days' time, all may be different." Coburn was nonplussed. He did not know what to say. It was clear Majid could not be talked around. Coburn and Taylor manhandled the fuel drum into the back of the Range Rover, then took their leave. Majid wished them luck. Back at the Devaranchek place, Coburn started trying to reach the cycle man, hoping he would replace Majid as driver. The cycle man was as elusive as Coburn himself. He could normally be reached at a certain phone number, some kind of revolutionary headquarters, Coburn suspected. Just once a day. The regular time for him to drop by this place was now past. It was late in the evening, but Coburn tried anyway. The cycle man was not there. He tried a few more phone numbers without success. At least they had Sayed. At 10:30, Coburn went out to meet Sayed. He walked through the darkened streets to Argentine Square, a mile from the Devaranchek place, then picked his way across a construction site and into an empty building to wait. At 11 o'clock, Sayed had not arrived. Simons had told Coburn to wait 15 minutes, no longer. But Coburn decided to give Sayed a little more time. He waited until 11:30. Sayed was not coming. Coburn wondered what had happened. Given Sayed's family connections, it was quite possible he had fallen victim to the revolutionaries. For the dirty team, this was a disaster. Now they had no Iranians to go with them. "How the hell will we get through all those roadblocks?" wondered Coburn. "What a shitty break. The professor drops out. Majid drops out. The cycle man can't be found. Then Sayed drops out. Shit." He left the construction site and walked away. Suddenly, he heard a car. He looked back and saw a jeep full of armed revolutionaries swinging around the square. He ducked behind a convenient bush. They went by. He went on, hurrying now, wondering whether the curfew was enforced tonight. He was almost home when the jeep came roaring back toward him. "They saw me last time," he thought, "and they've come back to pick me up." It was very dark. They might not have spotted him yet. He turned and ran back. There was no cover on this street. The noise of the jeep became louder. At last, Coburn saw some shrubbery and flung himself into it. He lay there listening to his heartbeat as the jeep came closer. Were they looking for him? Had they picked up Sayed and tortured him and made him confess that he had an appointment with a capitalist American pig at Argentine Square at 10:45? The jeep went by without stopping. Coburn picked himself up. He ran all the way to the Devaranchek place. He told Simons they now had no Iranian drivers. Simons cursed. "Is there another Iranian we can call?" "Only one. Rashid." Simons did not want to use Rashid, Coburn knew, because Rashid had led the jailbreak, and if someone who remembered him from that should see him driving a carload of Americans, there might be trouble. But Coburn could not think of anyone else. "Okay," said Simons. "Call him." Simons dialed Rashid's number. He was at home. "This is Jay Coburn. I need your help." "Sure." Coburn did not want to give the address of the hideout over the phone, in case the line was wiretapped. He recalled that Bill Devaranchek had a slight squint. He said, "You remember the guy with the funny eye?" "With the funny eye? Oh, yeah." "Don't say his name. Remember where he used to live?" "Sure. Don't say it." "That's where I am. I need you here." "Jay, I live miles from there, and I don't know how I'm going to get across the city." "Just try," Coburn said. He knew how resourceful Rashid was. Give him a task, and he just hated to fail. "You'll get here." "Okay. Thanks." Coburn hung up. It was midnight. Paul and Bill had each picked a passport from the ones Gaydon had brought from the States, and Simons had made them learn the names, dates of birth, personal details, and all the visas and country stamps. The photograph in Paul's passport looked more or less like Paul, but Bill's was a problem. None of them was right, and he ended up with the passport of Larry Humphreys, a blonde, rather Nordic type, who really did not look like Bill. The tension mounted as the six men discussed details of the journey they would begin within the next few hours. There was fighting in Tabriz, according to Rich Gallagher's military contacts, so they would stick to the plan of taking the low road south of Lake Rezaie, passing through Mahabad. The story they would tell, if questioned, would be as close to the truth as possible, always Simon's preference when lying. They would say they were businessmen who wanted to get home to their families, the airport was closed, and they were driving to Turkey. In support of that story, they would carry no weapons. It was a difficult decision. They knew they might regret being unarmed and helpless in the middle of a revolution, But Simons and Coburn had found on the reconnaissance trip that the revolutionaries at the roadblocks always searched for weapons. Simons' instinct told him they would be better off talking their way out of trouble than trying to shoot their way out. They also decided to leave behind the 55-gallon fuel drums on the grounds that they made the team look too professional, too organized for businessmen quietly driving home. They would, however, take a lot of money. Joe Pache and the clean team had gone off with $50,000, but Simon's crew still had around $250,000, some of it in Iranian rials, Deutschmarks, sterling, and gold. They packed $50,000 into kitchen baggies, weighted the bags with shot, and put them in a gas can. They hid some in a Kleenex box, and more in the battery hold of a flashlight. They passed the rest out for each to conceal about his person. At 1 o'clock, Rashid still had not arrived. Simon sent Coburn to stand at the street gate and watch for him. Coburn stood in the darkness, shivering, hoping Rashid would show up. They would leave tomorrow, with or without him, but without him they might not get far. The villagers in the countryside would probably detain Americans just on general principles. Rashid would be the ideal guide, despite Simon's worries. The kid had a silver tongue. Coburn's thoughts turned to home. Liz was mad at him, that he knew. She had been giving Merv Stoffer a hard time, calling every day and asking where her husband was and what he was doing and when he was coming home. Coburn knew he would have to make some decisions when he got home. He was not sure that he was going to spend the rest of his life with Liz. And after this episode, maybe she would begin to feel the same way. I suppose we were in love, once upon a time, he thought. Where did all that go? He heard footsteps. A short, curly-haired figure was walking along the sidewalk toward him, shoulders hunched against the cold. Rashid, hissed Coburn. Jay? Boy, am I glad to see you. Coburn took Rashid's arm. Let's go inside. They went into the living room. Rashid said hello to everyone, smiling and blinking. He blinked a lot, especially in moments of excitement, and he had a nervous cough. Simon sat him down and explained the plan to him. Rashid blinked faster. When he understood what was being asked of him, he became a little self-important. I will help you on one condition, he said, and coughed. I know this country, and I know this culture. You are all important people in EDS, but this is not EDS. If I lead you to the border, you must agree to do everything I say, without question. Coburn held his breath. Nobody talked like this to Simons, but Simons grinned. Anything you say, Rashid. A few minutes later, Coburn got Simons in a corner and said quietly, Colonel, did you mean that about Rashid being in charge? Sure, said Simons. He's in charge as long as he's doing what I want. Coburn knew, better than Simons, how hard it was to control Rashid, even when Rashid was supposed to be obeying orders. On the other hand, Simons was the most skilled leader of small groups Coburn had ever met. Then again, this was Rashid's country, and Simons did not speak Farsi. The last thing they needed on this trip was a power struggle between Simons and Rashid. Coburn got on the phone to Dallas and spoke to Merv Stoffer. Paul had encoded a description of the dirty team's proposed route to the border, and Coburn now gave Stoffer the coded message. Then they discussed how they would communicate en route. It would probably be impossible to call Dallas from countryside payphones, so they decided they would pass messages through an EDS employee in Tehran, Golam. Golam was not to know he was being used this way. Coburn would call Golam once a day. If all was well, he would say, I have a message for Jim Neifler. We are okay. Once the team reached Rezaieh, he would add, We are at the staging area. Stoffer, in his turn, would simply call Golam and ask whether there were any messages. So long as all went well, Golam would be kept in the dark. If things went wrong, the pretense would be abandoned. Coburn would level with Golam, tell him what the trouble was, and ask him to call Dallas. Stoffer and Coburn had become so familiar with the code that they could hold a discussion using mostly ordinary English mixed with a few letter groups and key code words and be sure that anyone listening in on a wiretap would be unable to figure out what they meant. Merv explained that Perot had contingency plans to fly into northwest Iran from Turkey to pick up the dirty team if necessary. Perot wanted the Range Rovers to be clearly identifiable from the air, so he proposed that each of them should have a large X on its roof, either painted or made of black electrician's tape. If a vehicle had to be abandoned because it broke down or ran out of gas or for any other reason, the X should be changed to an A. There was another message from Perot. He had talked with Admiral Moorer, who had said that things were going to get worse and the team should get out of there. Coburn told Simons this. Simons said, Tell Admiral Moorer that the only water here is in the kitchen sink. I look out the window, I see no ships. Coburn laughed and told Stoffer, We understand the message. It was almost 5 a.m. There was no more time to talk. Stoffer said, Take care of yourself, Jay. He sounded choked up. Keep your head down, you hear? I sure will. Good luck. Bye, Merv. Coburn hung up. As dawn broke, Rashid went out in one of the Range Rovers to reconnoiter the streets. He was to find a route out of the city, avoiding roadblocks. If the fighting was heavy, the team would consider postponing their departure another 24 hours. At the same time, Coburn left in the second Range Rover to meet with Golam. He gave Golam cash to cover the next payday at Bucharest and said nothing about using Golam to pass messages to Dallas. The object of the exercise was a pretense of normality so that it would be a few days before the remaining Iranian employees began to suspect that their American bosses had left town. When he got back to the Dvoranchek place, the team discussed who should go in which car. Rashid should drive the lead car, obviously. His passengers would be Simons, Bill, and Keen Taylor. In the second car would be Coburn, Paul, and Gayden. Simons said, "Coburn, you're not to let Paul out of your sight till you're in Dallas. Taylor, the same goes for you and Bill." Rashid came back and said the streets were remarkably quiet. "All right," said Simons. "Let's get this show on the road." Keen Taylor and Bill went out to fill the gas tanks of the Range Rovers from the 55-gallon drum. The fuel had to be siphoned into the cars, and the only way to start the flow was to suck the fuel through. Taylor swallowed so much gasoline that he went back into the house and vomited, and for once, nobody laughed at him. Coburn had some pep pills that he had bought on Simon's instructions at a Tehran drugstore. He and Simons had had no sleep for 24 hours straight, and now they each took a pill to keep them awake. Paul emptied the kitchen of every kind of food that would keep, crackers, cupcakes, canned puddings, and cheese. It was not very nutritious, but it would fill them. Coburn whispered to Paul, "Make sure we get the cassette tapes, so we can have some music in our car." Bill loaded the cars with blankets, flashlights, and can openers. They were ready. They all went outside. As they were getting into the cars, Rashid said, "Paul, you drive the second car, please. You are dark enough to pass for Iranian if you don't speak." Paul glanced at Simons. Simons gave a slight nod. Paul got behind the wheel. They drove out of the courtyard and into the street.
Chapter 11. As the dirty team drove out of the Dvoranchek place, Ralph Bulwer was at Istanbul Airport, waiting for Ross Perot. Bulwer had mixed feelings about Perot. Bulwer had been a technician when he joined EDS. Now he was a manager. He had a fine big house in a white Dallas suburb, and an income few black Americans could ever hope for. He owed it all to EDS and to Perot's policy of promoting talent. They didn't give you all this stuff for nothing, of course. They gave it for brains and hard work and good business judgment. But what they did give you for nothing was the chance to show your stuff. On the other hand, Bulwer suspected Perot wanted to own his men body and soul. That was why ex-military people got on well at EDS. They were comfortable with discipline and used to a 24-hour-a-day job. Bulwer was afraid that one day he might have to decide whether he was his own man or Perot's. He admired Perot for going to Iran. For a man as rich and comfortable and protected as that to put his ass on the line the way he had, that took some balls. There was probably not one other chairman of the board of an American corporation who would conceive the rescue plan, let alone participate in it. And then again, Bulwer wondered, all his life he would wonder, whether he could ever really trust a white man. Perot's Lease 707 touched down at 6 a.m. Bulwer went on board. He took in the lush decor at a glance and then forgot about it. He was in a hurry. He sat down with Perot. "I'm catching a plane to 6:30, so I gotta make this fast," he said. "You can't buy a helicopter and you can't buy a light plane." "Why not?" "It's against the law. You can charter a plane, but it won't take you just anywhere you want to go. You charter for a specified trip." "Who says?" "The law. Also, chartering is so unusual that you'll have the government all over you asking questions, and you might not want that." "Now, just a minute, Ralph. Not so fast," said Perot. He had that I'm the boss look in his eye. "What if we get a helicopter from another country and bring it in? I've been here a month, and I've looked into all this thoroughly, and you can't rent a helicopter and you can't rent a plane. And I have to leave now to meet Simons at the border." Perot backed off. "Okay. How are you going to get there?" "Mr. Fish got us a bus to go to the border. It's on its way already. I was going with it, but I had to stay behind to brief you. I'm going to fly to Adana, that's about halfway, and catch up with the bus there. I got Ilsman with me. He's the Secret Service guy, and another guy to translate. What time do the fellows expect to reach the border?" 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon," said Perot. "It's going to be tight. I'll see you guys later." He ran back to the terminal building and just made his flight. Ilsman, the fat secret policeman, and the interpreter, Bulwer did not know his name, so he called him Charlie Brown, were on board. They took off at 6:30. They flew east to Ankara, where they waited several hours for their connection. At midday, they reached Adana, near the biblical city of Tarsus in south-central Turkey. The bus was not there. They waited an hour. Bulwer decided the bus was not going to come. With Ilsman and Charlie Brown, he went to the information desk and asked about flights from Adana to Van, a town about 100 miles from the border crossing. There were no flights to Van from anywhere. "Ask where we can charter a plane," Bulwer told Charlie. Charlie asked, "There are no planes for charter here." "Can we buy a car?" Cars are very scarce in these parts of the country. Are there no car dealers in town? If there are, they won't have any cars to sell. Is there any way to get the van from here? No. It was like the joke about the tourist who asks a farmer for directions to London, and the farmer replies, "If I was going to London, I wouldn't start from here." They wandered out of the terminal and stood beside the dusty road. There was no sidewalk. This was really the sticks. Bulwer was frustrated. So far, he'd had it easier than most of the rescue team. He had not even been to Tehran. Now that it was his turn to achieve something, it looked as though he would fail. Bulwer hated to fail. He saw a car approaching with some kind of markings in Turkish on its side. "Hey," he said, "is that a cab?" "Yes," said Charlie. "Hell, let's get a cab." Charlie hailed the cab and they got in. Bulwer said, "Tell him we want to go to Van." Charlie translated. The driver pulled away. After a few seconds, the driver asked a question. Charlie translated. "Van where?" "Tell him Van Turkey." The driver stopped the car. Charlie said, "He says, do you know how far it is?" Bulwer was not sure, but he knew it was halfway across Turkey. "Tell him yes." After another exchange, Charlie said, "He won't take us." "Does he know anyone who will?" The driver shrugged elaborately as he replied. Charlie said, "He's going to take us to the cab stand so we can ask around." "Good." They drove into the town. The cab stand was just another dusty piece of road with a few cars parked, none of them new. Yılmaz